Welcome back for another deep dive with us. This time, we're going to be looking at public administration, but through a bit more of a political lens.
Right.
We're really interested in seeing how decisions get made, especially around, you know, how information and technology are used in government, how institutions shape that.
Yeah.
So the excerpts that we're looking at today are from an academic text on institutional perspectives on public administration.
Yeah, it's a very dense text.
Oh, I bet.
Full of insights, though.
It sounds fascinating.
It is.
So the source material starts off by sort of critiquing the traditional concept of administration.
Mm-hmm.
It basically says that it's kind of outdated and oversimplified.
Right.
And really fails to capture how politics and administration are just completely, you know, intertwined.
Yeah, the traditional concept really misses the role that administration plays in influencing the political process itself.
Right. So it's not like the decisions are made by the politicians and then
handed
down to the administrators and they just carry it out.
Exactly. It's much more of a back and forth.
Yeah.
The source actually highlights four different ways that administration influences the whole process.
Oh, wow.
First, there's like agenda setting.
Okay.
Then there's the design of the solutions,
mm-hmm.
choosing which solutions are going to actually be implemented, and then, of course, actually implementing those solutions.
So the administrators really have a huge influence over, you know, how a policy actually looks.
Absolutely. A lot of power there.
Wow. So just to delve deeper into this, the source explores three alternative perspectives on how decisions are made in public institutions.
Okay.
So we've got the economic perspective, the sociological perspective, and then the historical institutionalism.
Right.
And I think all three of these are trying to grapple with, you know, where does the power really lie?
Yeah. And how do institutions really work, especially in a way that challenges that traditional view of everything being radical and efficient?
Right. Because like we were saying, it's messy.
Exactly.
So let's start with the economic neo-institutionalism.
Okay.
What is that all about?
Cool. So I think a simple way to think about this is like follow the money.
All right.
Economic neo-institutionalism kind of takes that idea and applies it to public administration.
Okay.
So it argues that everyone, even in public service, is kind of looking out for their own interests, trying to maximize their own utility.
Okay, so it's not just about serving the public good, you know?
Right. But it's not this purely altruistic system.
Yeah.
There's personal ambition.
Mm.
And this is where the concept of opportunism comes in.
Okay, so break down opportunism for me.
So opportunism in this context basically means that individuals might, you know, use some deceit. Mm-hmm. They might withhold information to get ahead.
Okay.
Especially if they have more knowledge than others.
Right. So information is power.
Absolutely. And the source gives a good example.
Okay.
A bureaucrat who, you know, maybe sees that a policy has flaws,
mm-hmm.
but they downplay those flaws to their higher ups.
Oh, yeah. Just to get it through.
Just to get it approved.
That makes sense.
Right.
So it's a bit Machiavellian, isn't it?
It can be.
Yeah. It makes you think, how often is that happening?
Right.
You know, where we're seeing like this really nice polished version, but behind the scenes that people are kind of scheming.
Right.
So how does the sociological neo-institutionalism differ from this perspective?
Okay. So while economic neo-institutionalism focuses on individual strategy,
mm-hmm.
sociological neo-institutionalism really looks at the role of norms, routines, and existing practices.
Okay.
So how these shape behavior within organizations.
So it's kind of like there's a culture of how things are done and people are more likely to just go with the flow.
Exactly. It's less about that kind of cold calculation of self-interest
mm-hmm.
and more about fitting in and doing what's seen as appropriate.
Okay.
And one of the key ideas here is something called path dependence.
Okay. I've heard that term. What does that mean?
Basically, path dependence means that past decisions can really influence present choices and even limit future options. Oh, okay. So it's like you're stuck on a certain trajectory because of what's happened before.
Exactly. Think about the QWERTY keyboard.
Oh, yeah.
Still use it today, even though there might be better layouts.
Right. Just because that's how we've always done it.
Exactly. That's path dependence in action.
And so you're saying this happens in government, too?
Absolutely. Agencies can get stuck in their ways doing things a certain way just because that's how it's always been done.
Even if it's not the best way.
Exactly. Even when there might be evidence that suggests another approach would be better.
Wow.
And to understand how decisions are made in this kind of context, the source digs into two really interesting decision-making models.
Okay.
The first one is called muddling through.
Okay.
And the second one is the garbage can model.
I like those names.
Yeah.
It's muddling through.
So muddling through basically means that solutions don't just appear fully formed.
Okay.
They emerge gradually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you kind of build on existing practices.
Well, it's like you don't necessarily have a goal in mind. You're just kind of taking it step by step.
Exactly. It's like making a stew.
Okay.
You add ingredients a little bit at a time, taste, and adjust as you go along.
Oh, that's a good analogy. I like that.
Right. Rather than having like a precise recipe that you follow to a T.
Right. It's very much like feeling your way through.
And the source argues that this muddling through approach is often how things happen in public administration.
Okay.
It's not always about these grand strategies.
Mm-hmm.
It's about adapting and responding to the immediate problems and constraints.
Okay, so that's muddling through. And then what about the garbage can model? What's that all about?
So imagine a literal garbage can.
Okay.
And you've got problems being tossed in.
Yeah.
You've got potential solutions being thrown in. And you have all these different people.
Oh, my gosh.
With their own interests and agendas kind of coming and going.
It's like chaos.
And somehow a decision emerges from this mess.
So it's not necessarily a rational process of, okay, here's the problem.
Right.
Let's come up with a solution.
This is just like we're throwing everything in a bucket.
Right.
And seeing what comes out.
Exactly.
Wow. So chance plays a role?
Absolutely. Timing plays a role.
So the solution that might be chosen isn't necessarily the best solution. It's just the one that happened to be in the can at the right time.
It's the one that someone grabbed and said, this is what we're doing.
Oh, my goodness.
So it really highlights the role of chance and these unpredictable interactions.
It sounds like how a lot of things happen in the real world.
It does, doesn't it?
So this is really making me think about, you know, we have these ideas of how decisions should be made.
Right.
But it sounds like the reality is much messier.
Exactly. And this leads to another interesting idea that the source explores.
Okay.
This concept that organizations often adapt to external expectations through symbolic actions.
I'm intrigued. What are symbolic actions?
So Meyer and Rowan, the scholars who kind of developed this idea, they argue that society has these, you know, institutionalized myths about how organizations should function.
Oh, like an ideal.
Exactly. And these myths often revolve around rationality and efficiency.
Okay, so we want to think that things are being done in this very, like, thoughtful way.
Right, in a perfectly rational way.
Yeah.
And so organizations then adopt, you know, formal structures and procedures to signal that they're complying with these myths.
Okay.
Even if behind the scenes things are much more messy and less rational.
So it's like putting on a show.
It is.
Yeah.
It's like you're playing a role, performing for a specific audience to maintain this image of legitimacy and competence.
It makes sense. You know, it's like putting on a good front.
Exactly. And this happens in public administration, too. You know, agencies might adopt policies or structures to appear responsive to public concerns, to appear responsive to political pressures, even if those policies don't actually have that much of an impact in reality.
So it's all about managing perceptions and not necessarily, you know, actually doing things.
Yeah.
It's about meeting those expectations that society has of how institutions should function.
Makes you think, you know, because like we were saying, there's probably a lot that goes on behind closed doors that we don't see.
Right.
And it's probably a lot more complex than we think.
It is. And understanding this, you know, this idea of symbolic adaptation can help us be more critical about, you know, the information that we're getting about how these institutions work.
Yeah. So we've talked about the economic and the sociological perspectives.
Right.
So what about historical institutionalism? What insights does that lens provide?
So historical institutionalism takes a long view.
Okay.
It looks at how institutions evolve over time and how that historical context shapes everything.
Okay.
So it's about recognizing that institutions aren't just these static things.
Yeah.
They carry the baggage of their past.
Right. So the decisions they're making today are based on, you know, decades or centuries of, you know, previous decisions.
Exactly. It's like understanding a family by looking at its genealogy and all the stories that have been passed down through generations.
Oh, I like that analogy. That's a good one.
Right. You can't just understand a family by looking at them this one moment in time.
Right.
You have to see where they came from.
Okay. So how do we apply that to like a government agency or a public institution?
Well, one key concept from historical institutionalism
yeah.
is this idea of institutional capacity.
Okay.
And that refers to the resources and formal positions that give individuals or groups the means to pursue their goals.
Okay. So it's like the tools that they have at their disposal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one of the key takeaways here is that control over technology and information can become a really powerful tool for maintaining those institutional positions.
Oh, interesting.
And for controlling access.
So knowledge is power. Basically.
Right. And the source gives some great historical examples of this.
Okay.
Think about the printing press.
Okay.
Or the early days of the internet. Whoever controlled access to those technologies held immense sway.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like even today, you know,
right.
Think about social media companies.
Exactly.
They have so much power.
Exactly. They control the flow of information.
Right.
They can shape public opinion.
Yeah.
And they can even influence elections.
Wow. So if we're thinking about public administration, you know, and the influence of politics and these different perspectives, what's the big takeaway? Like, what should we as, you know, citizens be thinking about when we look at these institutions?
Well, I think each of these perspectives really pushes us to look beyond that traditional view of public administration as this purely rational and apolitical system.
Right.
It's about recognizing the influence of institutions, whether it's through rules, norms, or these historical power structures that we've been talking about, and how all of that shapes the decisions that are made and how they're implemented.
Okay.
It's much more complex and much more nuanced. Mm.
And we really need to be aware of that.
Exactly. And one of the most important things to remember is that control over information and technology, that's not neutral.
Right.
That can be a really potent source of power within these institutions.
So we need to be really, you know,
aware,
critical and aware of how that information is being used.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, this has been super interesting.
Yeah.
I'm already looking forward to diving into part two of this.
Me too.
Where we can explore even more of these ideas and how they play out in the real world.
I think that'll be really fascinating.
Okay, great. Well, we'll see you then.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it really is amazing how just having access to information can, you know, completely shift the power dynamics.
Absolutely. And it makes you think about, you know, how that's happening today.
Right.
In ways that we might not even be aware of.
Yeah. So we've talked about how, you know, institutions are shaped by all these different factors like past decisions and cultural norms and even just like the image that they want to project.
Yeah.
But how does that actually like play out when decisions are being made within those institutions?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Like, is it really as chaotic as that garbage can model suggests?
Or
is there some kind of method to the madness?
The source material suggests that it's often a bit of both. You know, there are these formal structures and procedures in place.
Right.
But in reality, decision making can be much more fluid and unpredictable.
It makes you wonder if those formal structures are really just, you know, for show.
Right.
Like to make things look more organized and rational than they actually are.
It's exactly what that concept of symbolic adaptation is all about.
Yeah.
You know, organizations use those formal structures, those institutional myths,
right,
to project this image of legitimacy and competence, even if behind the scenes things are a lot messier.
So they're basically putting on a performance for a certain audience, whether it's the public or, you know, political overseers or even other institutions.
It's about managing those perceptions and meeting those external expectations.
But is that necessarily a bad thing?
That's a good question.
I mean, isn't there some value in having a sense of order and predictability, even if it's partly for show?
Yeah, I think the source material doesn't necessarily say that it's always a bad thing.
Okay.
It's more about recognizing that it exists and understanding the motivations behind it.
So it's not about saying that all institutions are being like deceptive or manipulative. It's just that there are these layers of complexity that we might not be aware of.
Right. And that understanding can help us be, you know, more savvy about the information that we're getting and more discerning about the decisions that we see being made.
Okay. So let's bring this back down to earth for a second.
Okay.
How can our listeners, you know, actually apply these ideas to the institutions that they interact with every day?
Yeah. So I think one of the most valuable things to take away from this deep dive is this idea that institutions are not these, you know, monolithic entities.
Right.
They're made up of people.
Yeah.
With their own motivations and agendas.
Okay.
And they're operating within this, you know, web of history and cultural norms.
Right. So it's not just about like reading the rule book.
Exactly.
It's about recognizing that there are all these human factors at play.
Right. And once you start to see institutions through that lens,
yeah,
you can ask some really critical questions.
Like what?
Like, who holds the power in this institution?
Okay.
What are their motivations?
Mm-hmm.
How are they using information and technology to advance their goals?
All right.
Are they genuinely serving the mission of the institution, or are they just trying to protect their own position?
Wow. That's giving me a lot to think about.
Right. It's like you suddenly have this new way of seeing things.
It's like getting a behind-the-scenes look at how the world really works.
Exactly. And that can be both exciting and a little bit daunting.
Okay, so let's zoom in on this issue of technology and information, because it's come up a few times, and it seems like it's especially important, you know, in the 21st century.
Absolutely. I mean, you hear people talking about how data is the new oil.
Right.
Or the new gold, and, you know, they're not wrong.
Yeah, because, like, whoever controls the data controls the future.
It really does. And so, understanding how institutions are viewing technology and information and how they're managing it,
mm-hmm.
that's absolutely crucial for understanding power in the 21st century.
So how can we use these institutional perspectives to make sense of the decisions that are being made about tech and information, you know, in the public sphere?
Right.
What should we be looking for?
Well, one key concept to keep in mind is that idea of path dependence that we talked about earlier.
Uh-huh.
And when it comes to technology, you know, this might mean that decisions made years ago, mm-hmm. maybe based on assumptions that are no longer valid or, you know, limited options that were available at the time.
Right.
Those decisions are still shaping how things are done today, even if they're not serving the public good anymore.
So it's like being stuck with a legacy system that no one wants to use, but they just can't get rid of.
Right. Or maybe they don't want to get rid of it because it benefits them in some way.
Okay. So what about those institutional myths? How do they play out when it comes to technology?
Well, one common myth is that technology is neutral.
Okay.
That it's just a tool that can be used for good or bad.
Right. Like it doesn't have its own agenda.
Right. But as we've been discussing, technology is always shaped by social and political forces.
Okay.
It's created by people. It's deployed by people.
So it's embedded in those systems.
Exactly. It reflects the values and priorities of the people who control it.
So it's not just about the tech itself. It's about who has the power to shape it.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
And another myth that we often hear is that more data is always better.
Okay. Yeah. Like if we just collect enough information, we can solve any problem.
Right. But that ignores the fact that data can be biased.
That's true.
It can reflect existing power structures and inequalities.
Right. It's not like data just magically appears.
Right.
It's collected by people with their own, you know, biases and agendas.
Exactly. And so if you're feeding biased data into a system,
right,
you're going to get biased results.
Garbage in, garbage out.
Exactly.
So how can we be more aware of how technology and information are being used in the public sphere?
Well, I think one thing to watch out for is a lack of transparency.
Okay.
If institutions are being secretive about how they're collecting and using data, that's a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
It might mean that they're more interested in protecting their own interests than in serving the public.
So we should be asking questions.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, who has access to this data?
Right.
What are they doing with it?
Exactly.
What are their motivations?
Right. And I think we also need to be wary of these claims that technology is a silver bullet.
Okay.
You know, this idea that it can magically solve all of our social problems.
Right.
Technology can be a powerful tool.
Yeah.
But it's not a substitute for, you know, good governance and ethical decision making.
It's not going to fix everything.
Exactly. And another thing to keep in mind is the concentration of power.
Okay.
You know, if a single company or a small group of individuals controls a vital technology or a vast amount of data,
it's dangerous.
That creates huge potential for abuse.
Uh-huh.
And we need to think about how that concentration of power might be reinforcing existing inequalities or even creating new ones.
That's a great point.
So it's about making sure that technology is being used in a way that benefits everyone.
Right.
Not just a select few.
Right. And that's going to require us to be informed and engaged.
Right.
And to really keep asking those critical questions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a lot to process, but I think, you know, we can't just bury our heads in the sand and pretend this isn't happening.
Absolutely. I think these are conversations that we need to be having more and more as technology just becomes, you know, even more intertwined with our lives.
Right. Like we can't just assume that technology is going to be used for good. We have to be active participants in shaping how it's developed and used.
I completely agree. You know, we can't just be passive consumers of technology.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be informed. We need to be engaged, and we need to hold those in power accountable.
So I feel like, you know, after this deep dive, I have a totally different view of public administration.
Yeah.
It's not just about, you know, following rules and filling out paperwork.
Right.
It's about understanding all these complex dynamics.
Exactly.
Political influences, the historical legacies, the way information is used strategically.
Right. And I think that can be both unsettling and empowering.
How so?
Well, unsettling because it reveals, you know, just how much manipulation and self-interest can be at play.
Yeah.
But also empowering because it gives us the tools to be more critical.
Okay.
More discerning about the decisions that are being made, you know, that affect our lives.
Okay. So as we wrap things up, what's like one final thought that we can leave our listeners with?
Okay. So think about the institutions that you interact with every day. At work, in your community, in broader society. Ask yourself how their history, how their internal power dynamics, and how they use technology might be shaping their decisions around information and access.
That's a good one. So, like, look for those signs of path dependence.
Right.
Those institutional myths that organizations use to maintain their image.
Exactly.
And how information itself is being used to influence people.
Right. It's about becoming aware of these dynamics so that we can really understand how the world works and maybe even challenge those dynamics when necessary.
It's like we've given our listeners a new pair of glasses.
Yeah.
A new way of seeing the world.
And a new way of seeing the world and the institutions that shape it.
And once you see it,
right.
It's hard to unsee it.
Exactly.
Well, that's all the time we have for this deep dive into public administration.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
And we'll see you next time.